Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us again for another Journal Club. Today, we will be talking about behavioral health and the impact that COVID-19 is having on behavioral health. And we're joined today by Dr. Mark Agronin, who I will introduce in a few moments. I just want to go over our agenda for today. We will give a brief overview of the state of the state, and then we're going to do our due diligence and move directly into discussing behavioral health. It is a very important topic, and we have not, as of yet, really done a deep dive into all of the issues that have arisen with COVID-19. There will be plenty of time to ask questions during our open discussion. So with that, Shane, if you proceed to the next slide, just want to give you a snapshot of where we're at. As of 9:33 this morning, we were at 98,933 deaths in the United States. That number has since moved, and unfortunately, it's approaching even higher numbers. What we have seen is that the amount of people who are passing away on a daily basis has decreased. So that is some good news in this overall situation. We will see what is going to start happening as we continue to see more states reopening and more businesses reopening. So we're always monitoring that. In Florida, if you go to the next slide, you'll see that as of this morning at 11 a.m., we have over 52,000 cases, with the majority of them being in Miami-Dade. That number, when I last checked, was over 17,000. So we are still seeing new cases. The rate of new cases is not as fast as we were a few weeks ago, but it is still something for us to keep a close eye on. And as I think I've said a couple of thousand times on these calls, is we do know the impact in our nursing facilities is going to be different. We're part of those hyper-local events that we have been seeing across the country. I do not want to, as I mentioned earlier, take up too much time because we are joined today, if you proceed to the next slide, by Dr. Mark Agronin. And if you've not had the pleasure of listening to Dr. Agronin speak, you know, then you're in for a real treat. Dr. Agronin, I'm not going to take up too much time introducing you, but I just want everyone to know that you are one of the leading experts for adult and geriatric psychiatry. I've heard you speak on many occasions and been able to read through some of your books, and I just really thank you for joining us today, and I turn the floor over to you.
Well, Diane, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity and really the honor to speak to the group today on a really important facet of the whole COVID-19 pandemic. And I'd like to talk in general about what we know today. I'll talk a little bit about some of the experiences we've had at Miami Jewish Health, and hope to have some good discussion today. So let's go to the first slide. So from one of the index papers that came out recently talking about some of the potential neuropsychiatric effects of COVID-19 had a quote that I think really sets the context here, and I'm just going to read it. Reports from the 18th and 19th century suggested influenza pandemics in particular have been marked by increased incidences of various neuropsychiatric symptoms such as insomnia, anxiety, depression, mania, psychosis, suicidality, and delirium. And you can see in the background is a photograph from the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, as it was called. So, you know, one thing that's clear is that even though this is a a virus that we have initially focused on as a respiratory virus. We know that it has many effects throughout the body. We've been understanding and appreciating that more as we gain more experience with this, and in particular neuropsychiatric effects. But in addition to that, there's a whole bevy of psychological impacts across the board that we need to focus on. So in the next slide, I'm going to cover the following areas. And I just want to say at the outset that even though all of us have gotten more than enough experience in dealing with this to date, what's clear is that there's still a tremendous amount we have to learn. The literature is only starting to see some initial papers out looking at the impact of COVID-19 on behavioral health. But I'll talk a little bit about what we know from some of the literature, but also talking about what is out in professional journals, what's out in trade journals, you know, what we're seeing, just a lot of good food for thought that we can talk about. So I'll cover the following areas. We'll talk about neuropsychiatric effects. So what are some of the direct impacts of this particular coronavirus on the brain and on the nervous system that have mental health consequences? We'll focus a little on that. Let's talk a little bit then about frontline caregivers and the stress and impact of working in environments now in a really unprecedented manner. We'll talk about the psychology of staying at home, what many of us are doing at least at some point, but what about our families, our friends, our loved ones? What are they going through? What are some of the mental health issues and how we can help? I like to then focus on long-term care settings. That's where I work, at a place called Miami Jewish Health, which actually has the largest nursing home in the state of Florida on grounds. And what are some of the mental health issues that not only we're seeing, but are being seen all over? Some lessons learned in terms of how can we address these issues. And then I'll talk right at the end about what we're doing on our campus in particular to try to make an impact here. So let's go to the first slide or the next slide. We know from a lot of preliminary data that whether we're talking about, you know, this particular coronavirus or just coronaviruses in particular, that they can invade and affect neurotissue, both in the brain and you know, peripheral nerves. We know that there are both acute effects. We also know that there are effects that linger for weeks to months. You know, close to 50% had very specific and pronounced neurological symptoms, ranging from headaches, paresthesias, stroke, and encephalopathy, or what we call delirium. And we know there's been a lot of press in the United States about the impact of the coronavirus on clotting, and how even younger people have been affected by strokes. It's not a large percentage, but we certainly have seen that. A lot of people also report just from the indirect effects of the hypoxia, having what people have called kind of a brain fog. But what we know is that there are certain, you know, mild, sometimes moderate neurocognitive changes that can occur acutely during the infection. We also know that people who have more severe symptoms, especially people who have the cytokinemia, or what we sometimes call cytokine storm, that they're at a significantly elevated risk for psychotic symptoms such as hallucinations, delusions, and also for delirium or encephalopathy. And often in people in some of the more severe and final stages, you see a really pronounced encephalopathy. And this can, and for people who survive, this is not something that just resolves within a few hours or days, but there can be symptoms persisting even when people have gone home and they're still recuperating. One thing we don't know about, but there's certainly interest and concern, is could there be some longer term post-infectious sequelae, something that would be immune mediated. You know, one historical example of this, or at least what was believed to be a historical example, is the what was called sleeping sickness, or Van Ekonomo's disease, named after the neurologist. This is a really concerning pandemic that affected millions of people right on the tail of the 1918 influenza epidemic. In fact, many people thought it was related, that it was a potential post-infectious sequelae of the influenza epidemic. Of course, in retrospect, we know it probably was a separate, if you can believe it, a separate pandemic happening almost at the same time. Now they believe it may have been related to an enterovirus, but you literally had millions of people developing these neurologic conditions as what was could have been an immune-mediated post-infectious condition, which resulted in Parkinsonism, encephalopathy with the sleepy part of it, fluctuations in consciousness. If any of you saw the movie Awakenings, which was based on the book by Oliver Sacks, this talked about many years later, someone who had this where L-DOPA was used to try to liberate them at least temporarily from some of the Parkinsonian effects. This is just one example of what we might call a post-infectious sequelae. The question is, will there be anything for this? Hopefully not, but it's something that we need to be obviously cognizant of. So that's basically, you know, summary of what we know and what we have seen and maybe anticipate in terms of direct neuropsychiatric effects of the coronavirus. In the next slide, I want to talk a little more in general about indirect effects. And let's focus on frontline caregivers to start with. We know if you look at any other pandemics over time, and you really can pick one, but there's a lot of the data from the past coronavirus pandemics, not this particular one, but with SARS and MERS in particular. What we see is for, you know, frontline individuals who are involved with these pandemics, it's an enormously stressful situation, in part because they're putting their health and lives on the line. Before the pandemics are appreciated, there's often not a good understanding of how it's transmitted or what the risks are, or how to mitigate that. And you see illness and death amongst coworkers. I think back towards when I was in medical school, right during the height of the HIV epidemic, and how at that time, you know, there really, even amongst the infectious disease specialists and fellows, there was not a good understanding about what, if anything, could be done for HIV. People basically understood transmission, but there's a lot that they didn't know at the time. And you were just witnessing people really severely ill and dying right in front of you. It was an enormously stressful time. And I think, you know, we've seen that during any pandemic. And you see an increased risk as a result for what are called acute stress reactions, which would be traumatic sequelae. People who become hypervigilant, they have trouble sleeping, they have intrusive memories, they have mood fluctuations. You see this acutely. And then you can see longer-term post-traumatic stress disorder in people as well from dealing in situations which are life-threatening and which they feel they have very little control over. And often by the time we really understand and appreciate what's going on, already we've sometimes failed to intervene in ways that would have been more effective right away. I would give the example, and in fact, I have to say that in doing a lot of talk and counseling with individuals on our own campus at times, it almost feels like you're in a battle zone. You know, people, their stress level is high, their adrenaline levels are elevated, which means that, you know, the body is preparing for a flight or fight reaction. And when your body becomes in a state of such high stress, you become hypervigilant, you're anticipating what might happen, it's hard to sleep, it affects so many other areas of your life, it affects your mood, it affects your appetite. And people really suffer during this time, and it's hard to work at times, it's hard to relax. And so what you often see is emergence in people, especially if people have a history of this, but also when they don't, of acute anxiety, of spontaneous panic attacks, feelings of depression, suicidal thoughts. And many of you probably saw in the news the really tragic situation of a frontline ER a physician working in the ER in New York, who just was overwhelmed with the stress and ended up, when she was away from it, taking her own life. These are really tragic situations, and ones which we have to look at as a really pernicious effect of this pandemic as well. There was a North American team of psychiatrists and other mental health professionals early during the pandemic, and they set up kind of a strike force to provide help at the time for colleagues in China. This is before it had spread from China. So they did both telephone and video contacts, working with Chinese healthcare workers. And what they found is different stages that people go through of emotional change. Sequentially, starting from the sense of bewilderment over what's happening around them, shock over just the scope of what they're seeing. And you can imagine what was going on in a lot of these New York City hospitals where, you know, there's just this an overwhelming number of people coming in, seeming, you know, threatened to overwhelm the system. And I'm sure you've talked to friends or colleagues who've described this as well. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people who require ICU level care, sites people have never seen before. The shock often turns to anger. You know, why weren't we more prepared? Why don't we have what we need? How are we going to deal with this? The next stage to talk about is anxiety, just this overwhelming sense of concern and worry. And if this is not dealt with, people become burnt out. They just can't do it anymore. They become desperate. And that's really at the point where people either drop out or they need to before they can get to more positive stages of basically accepting the situation, trying to take enough action to give them hope and to get over it. And what this team felt is that for these frontline caregivers, the best time to intervene is between the stages of anger and anxiety. So before people get so overwhelmed that they can't function or they can't function well, they get burned out. And you know, basically using time-limited but professional therapeutic tools. This is not a time just for, casual talk, whatnot, but really getting mental health professionals in who can use different assessment tools that are validated, who can use therapeutic techniques that are known. And just to give you an example, you know, in terms of like debriefing for people to prevent PTSD, that's not necessarily the best approach. Often, you know, the best approach is to just give people kind of the time and the space, but in a way that's being monitored and being assessed to cope with this, giving people breaks. And again, I think the analogy sometimes in wartime is good. During the first part of the Second World War, especially during the North African campaign, there wasn't a really good understanding of PTSD. They called it shell terms and concepts from World War I, which never were fully developed. And so they often lost so many soldiers to this who couldn't go back because they really didn't know how to manage it. You know, they didn't know about the type of break they needed to give them just that time to decompress before they can get them back in the situation. And so the better we understand this, the better that we can intervene for these frontline caregivers. These are really, really serious issues because, you know, if you're already losing frontline caregivers to illness, so staffing is being affected by that, and now you're losing people to fear, anxiety, burnout, you put yourself at risk of not having enough staff on hand. And then if you're getting a surge, what do you do? So, you know, part of the threat of systems being overloaded is not just in terms of whether you have enough equipment or whether you have enough beds, but do you have enough staff? And do you have enough staff that can effectively provide caregiving? And that's going to survive through this and be prepared for what may come next. Next slide. So if we broaden the circle now, let's look at basically all of us, people staying at home, people maybe not working in healthcare. This has been referred to in one article as a pandemic of anxiety and stress. And I thought this was well represented in one survey that was done for a group on behalf of the American Psychiatric Association. And they basically interviewed about 1,000 individuals, 18 and older, and asked them questions, you know, like, do you agree with this? I'm anxious about getting the virus. I'm anxious about family and loved ones getting it. I'm anxious about spreading it, dying from it, having a serious impact in my life, running out of supplies. Now, I think all of us say, well, of course, we're worried about this. But it's, you know, just look at the numbers and you can see that in every category, from a third to nearly half of individuals are really reporting this acute anxiety over these issues. So if you know, a third to a half of us are really feeling the significant anxiety and stress, you can bet that not a third or half of us are getting any sort of formal intervention with this. And what happens is that, you know, this anxiety and stress sets the stage for worsening mental health issues in a way that the system just has no way to deal with. And then you see all sorts of other sequelae that follow from this. So, you know, just making the point about how common these worries are, but I also hope it will normalize it as well. I don't think anyone is immune to this. And I often thought about this because as I was working on our at our facility and talking to people and counseling and helping people, what I really appreciated is often people turning to me and saying, well, how are you doing? You know, what's going on with you? How are you feeling? And I would liken that to the fact that, you know, whether we are a professional, an expert, whatever, all of us need care during this time. All of us need people to talk to, and we'll focus a little bit on that towards the end of the presentation. Next slide. So let's talk about the psychology of staying at home. You know, something we've never had to do before in our lifetime. You know, this social isolation for many people is involved, you know, has lack of stimulation, it has boredom. There's only so many Zoom conferences you can go to. You know, it's forcing us to, you know, do things that we enjoy doing, you know, watching Netflix and movies and hanging out, but only so much of that can you take. You know, we don't have access to all the different things that help to reduce stress. So going to the gym, you know, getting your hair done or your nails done, just wandering about and going shopping, you know, going to a restaurant or bar. These are things that help people decompress, to socialize, to have human contact. And it's one thing not to have that for, you know, a couple days, 2 weeks, but when you're going on 3 to 4 months without that, and now even longer, it can really begin to take a toll. And it doesn't give people all the ways of decompressing stress before. The other thing is people don't have the same access to medical or mental health services. And one thing that's really daunting to think about is, you know, we see the death rate directly from COVID-19. We saw the slide at the beginning, and that itself is huge and tragic. But we know for certain that many people probably died at home because they didn't get the services that they needed, you know, whether it was stroke or heart attack, people waited too long, or they didn't go in and get care, they're afraid to go. And that certainly led to significant morbidity and mortality that it's going to take us a long time to really to quantify and understand. You know, mental health, I think many of us have scrambled to do telehealth. And I can tell you, it's good, it works, it's helpful, but it's hard to, you know, get a full reach to everyone who needs it. A lot of people who previously were stable in their psychiatric illness have had relapses, especially anxiety disorders, panic disorders. I'm beginning to see now 3-4 months into it, people who were very stable before are now starting to have difficulty. So on the one hand, you say, hey, but we're opening up a little bit, people can do more, but the toll to some extent has already been taken on many people. The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, staying at home for some people only keeps them together in situations where there may be marital or family discord, there may be abuse, and this is all now confined and hidden within the home. And so for some people, this has become an excruciatingly difficult time. And, you know, finally, one thing that I recently, in April, did an article in the Wall Street Journal focusing on this is how do we communicate across generations? And do we, in some ways, speak different languages, whether we're in our 20s, 30s, 40s versus in our 80s and 90s. And the article was inspired to some extent by a conversation I had with my own parents at the beginning of this. And, you know, my dad was kind of expressing, you know, a cavalier attitude about, well, I need to go out and do this and see my friends. And I basically said, you can't do anything, you know, you need to stay at home. And it was, you know, it started off a little bit contentious. And I thought, you know, boy, this is not a good way to communicate. Clearly what I'm saying to him and what he's saying to me are two different things. This is not unique to my father and me. This is something that many people have talked about, how, you know, younger generations that are, you know, are used to kind of retreating to Netflix and video chats and into the internet, very different from older generations who that doesn't come as naturally, as reflexively. What they're used to is going out with their domino group or their study group or the, you know, going to church or synagogue or mosque or wherever, you know, having a prayer group and not having that. And especially knowing, you know, you don't have years and decades ahead if you're missing that. You know, for some people missing 4, 6, 8 months, that could be a good chunk of the time they have left. And so I think this, even though people realized I better stay at home, that's safer, I think that instinct, that expression was taken in a very negative way by many younger people who now maybe weren't as involved with them before, but see themselves in the role of their protectors. And so a lot of this contentious discussions going on, I think we need to understand better and recognize what we're really trying to say. Younger people have to be more patient and more understanding. You know, if you've grown up in a digital world and you're working with people who grew up in an analog world, you have to give time to bridge that gap. All my patients are in the 80s and 90s, and getting them on Doxy and Zoom and FaceTime, whatever, is a challenge. But it's something that, you know, if you're not patient, if you're not understanding, you're not flexible, it can lead to a lot of frustration across the board. And it doesn't matter how well we know this, you know, that technology can be difficult. I know doing these webinars sometimes, even that, getting slides, getting them here, there, setting things up. I did a webinar last night, and I did it from work where I have three different screens, and I had the slides were up beautifully, but they're on a screen that no one could see. And I realized that, I could hear in my mind, my, 23-year-old son saying, Dad, you can't, what do you know about using this technology? So it doesn't matter how much we know, there's always people who know more than we do. But these generational differences and outlook and needs and communication make a big difference. On the other hand, there's a potential to bridge some gaps and to do some really amazing things. I'm sure a lot of you have had conversations with people, with family members that you never really had before. A lot of family reunions, family gatherings in ways. So it can work both ways, but I would say even in the best, if it's working, this is not a substitute for that person-to-person or group contact. And so at some point, we need to get back to that. Next slide.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Long-term care I wanted to talk about because we've really come to understand that one of the biggest reservoirs for COVID-19 infections and the area in which we see some of the greatest tragic losses are long-term care settings across the board, nursing homes, assisted living facilities. I don't care how much you try to prepare for this, there is no way to fully prepare for this pandemic coming in. You know, you had to go within days out, how do you screen everyone appropriately and get people to come in and make sure you protect residents? How do you get the finances, and forget about finances, how do you just get a hold of enough personal protective equipment or PPE to outfit everyone and outfit them appropriately? You know, it's been like a free-for-all, like the Wild West trying to do that. Even if you have the finances or adequate finances to do that. And yet if you look at long-term care settings, once you get it in one person, there is vulnerable to get it in more staff and more individuals as well. And part of the challenge is that, the media loves to jump on this. And I think that when you see the push and pull between wanting to release data, not wanting to release data and whatnot, I think a lot of it stems from this concern about what stories are going to be told. There's no question you have settings in which, things have not gone well, but you have settings in which it's been absolutely heroic. You also have settings in which there are a lot of losses and settings and not. So everyone is at risk with this. So let's go into these settings and talk about it for a little bit. And what are some of the behavioral health issues? You know, you have residents who not only are they now socially isolated because they have to be confined to their room, they can't have family visitors anymore, but they're not getting the same exercise or physical therapy. They're not getting as much sunlight. And we know sunlight has a lot to do with regulating circadian rhythms. It has huge effects on mood. They have reduced access to both medical and mental health services because either they can't go out or the consultants can't come in. So already that's taking a toll. People are bored. There's lack of socialization. Even when you have staff trying to help out as much as possible, it's no substitute for family and friends and volunteers coming in for group activities. On the other hand, keep in mind, for a lot of these people, socialized isolation is not necessarily a new experience. A lot of these people are used to it because even at the best of times, they might not have the amount of visitation or socialization that they really need. And so in some ways, they may be more adaptable to this, at least initially. Video chats are a reasonable substitute for some time, but I think over time, it's not enough. And I would say what I think we're beginning to see across the board is people have done okay and adapted up till now. But once you get 3-4 months into it, you really begin to see this increase in sadness, anxiety, even in failure to thrive in some people. I think these may be the long-term consequences of being isolated in one's room. So when I say social isolation, it's not just not seeing or talking to a lot of people, it's being in your room and in that small space over time. Just that physical touch, voice contact is very powerful. We underestimate its role, especially for people that we think, well, even someone with later stages of different neurocognitive disorders, maybe they can't communicate as well, they have severe aphasia, they don't recognize people. Regardless, that soothing, gentle physical touch, voices, contact really is important and makes a difference. And if anything, we're really beginning to appreciate its absence once you get 3 to 4 months into it. Next slide. So how can we respond to all these challenges across the board? And these are just a few thoughts I had, and then I'll talk more specifically about what I've been trying to spearhead at our facility. We have to look at mental health issues both as acute consequences of COVID-19 infections, as I mentioned, not just from the direct impact of the virus for people infected, but also potential long-term sequelae of this pandemic, not only in terms of neural damage that may occur in people infected, but people working in the front lines, people just sequestering because of this. It's this wave that's going to keep on reverberating over time, and also living under the fear of what comes next. It's really important to aggressively identify and treat emergent mood and anxiety disorders, neurocognitive changes, delirium. We know in general that these are harbingers of worsening function, of excess disability over time. And so it's really important to be able to intervene, not just in terms of helping, but identifying what's going on. Because sometimes by the time it's even diagnosed, you're so far down the road, we want to try to be proactive in that. Frontline staff really need this term I heard. I really love this term. I did not coin this term, emotional PPE. I'm going to give it my own spin, my own definition here, but I would call emotional PPE, pre and post stress surveillance and reduction techniques. So what I mean is that just as if you're preparing to go into a unit, you put on your PPE, you do what you need to do, then you leave, you take it off. We need to think about mental health interventions in the same way. How do you prepare people for what's coming? How do you help them cope in the moment, and how do you work with them afterwards? And so you do, and I'll talk about how we've done this. But there's ways that people can identify and reduce stress. Lots of techniques. There's virtual support groups, individual counseling for people in terms of anxiety, depression, grief, especially if they've lost a lot of patients on PTSD symptoms. When you think about some of these frontline caregivers, and especially places, all over the country, but I think in particular, we've heard so much about these hospitals in New York that are just overwhelmed. Imagine when you're working the front line, people describing they barely have time to go from person to person, and there are people there who are literally dying alone in front of them. And it's one thing to see this here and there in your work, but when you see this multiple times every day, absolutely it takes a toll on people. And so how do we deal with that? How do we prepare people, and how do we help them through this? We also know in terms of long-term care, people need to be socially mobilized as soon as possible to increase family and staff contact, to get them involved in meaningful, stimulating activities. It's hard to do that when someone's confined to their room. So are there ways around it or ways to do it safely? And again, we have to keep in mind that, you know, most of the what we're following now, these are governor mandated rules and restrictions. They have to be followed. And there's a good reason that they're in place and they have to be followed. And so it's not like you can, you know, as creative as you want to be, people need to be in their rooms and kept safe. A really important term here, resilience, meaning, you know, from a physiologic standpoint, you're trying to restore homeostasis, but from a psychological standpoint, you're trying to help someone cope and adapt to adversity and get back to, you know, stable baseline. It's through giving and receiving support and empathy from others. I mean, for many of us, and I found this myself, when people would say, well, Dr. Grundin, how are you caring for yourself? You're here talking to us and trying to care for us. For me, it was a mutual aspect. Being able to give can be as powerful as receiving. We have to be open to both. What we've realized is that, you know, this notion that independence is the you know, the greatest, you know, the highest goal for us, you know, not necessarily. There's healthy dependence on others. We're all dependent on one another. We need to appreciate that and to, you know, be able to give and accept and receive from other people. That's part of a good teamwork. It's part of good, you know, a family, a couple, whatever. But altruism can be very helpful and healthy as well. And then the last slide. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the, putting a lot of this together, what we've learned over this time, what's effective, and you know, maybe these are, my guess is, all of you, you know, in the discussion today, you're doing these things, you're involved in these things. But, you know, just to share things that I found to be effective. So thinking about that term emotional PPE, you know, for us working with staff, everything has to be multilingual. When we speak to them, materials we give them, you know, everything we do in English, Spanish, and Creole for our particular staff. But really providing education. What is stress? How does stress manifest? What are some basic ways to reduce it? We have to just tell people this over and over again so they really understand it. And so, you know, we would tell people, recognize that stress is not just, you know, yelling and screaming and pulling your hair out. Stress can be manifested in changes in sleep and appetite. It can be anxiety. It can be irritability as well. It can be withdrawal, social isolation. So if you feel this or you see this in colleagues, realize that that may be, you know, one way stress is playing out. We teach people basic deep breathing relaxation techniques. It's incredibly effective and powerful. When people are in the heat of the moment, we encourage them, you have to take breaks. You have to hydrate yourself. You know, when you're wearing extra PPE on you, you will sweat more from stress. You'll sweat more from the heat of whether you're wearing a gown, a jumpsuit, a mask, whatever. You know, make sure you extra hydrate yourself because, you know, when you're hydrated even a little bit, you don't think as clear. Your mood tends to be more irritable. You just don't feel well. And we talk a lot about sleep and good sleep hygiene because that break, when people leave that sleep, is really, really important. And I told people when you go home, this is during really the height of this, you know, when you're kind of have a changing station at the threshold of your house, not just in terms of safety. I'm not sure that, you know, what you wear at work, you're necessarily, if you're exposed, you're bringing this into your home. But just as a transition point that work is done, what you're wearing, your uniform, you take off, you go in your house and that's where you're there to relax, to be with family, to, you know, kind of cleanse the day from your body. And really have a break. That's so important for people to be able to do that. We also set up daily staff huddles. I think these are, I call them key touch points, where staff can gather outside. We would give them updates on what's going on, give them reassurance, try to inspire them. I mean, I talked about them as being heroes of saving lives. That's literally what they were doing. They needed to hear that. And education, you know, you can't talk enough about how do you stay safe yourself? How do you use PPE properly? And just give people opportunity to vent, to ask questions. Those huddles, to me, I found probably the single most effective thing that we did. Even sometimes when the night shift would come out, we'd be standing out in the parking lot and people would walk by us. Hi, how are you doing? What's going on? What questions do you have? Giving people an opportunity to vent could be very effective. We had a mental health hotline. We still set up. People can call any issue, any question. It's all confidential. And it's basically to help identify and triage people who just need some, whether it's an individual talk, whether they need some counseling, whether they need a referral to professional mental health services. We made sure that there would be no issues with access to these services. All someone had to do is pick up the phone, call, leave a message, someone would get back to them, and whatever they needed, we would provide. So I wanted them to know they had that safety net regardless. I really encourage people, everyone I work with and talk to check in with one another. I call this taking your emotional pulse. Amongst all staff, you know, anyone who has medical training, you know, you've heard this adage that, you know, the first time you walk into a code, you should take your own pulse as a way of assessing, you know, are you so nervous that you're not going to be effective? Same thing here. I tell people, you know, your emotional pulses, how fast are you breathing? How fast is your heart beating? Are you focusing? Are you overwhelmed? You know, what emotion are you feeling? And what is that telling you about how you're dealing with stress and how you're going to cope with the situation? And, you know, we also really encouraged, now, you know, broadening the scope with staff and family, you know, these virtual visits. We had our whole therapeutic activity staff still doing this, phone and video hookups to talk to people, get families involved. And also for people, can we do room-based activities? So we have this internal, you know, television channel. So we do like a virtual bingo and people can watch the bingo screen. They have it set in their room and then they can call in. We can do quiz shows that way. I know, you know, this is where you need someone who can set up the technology. It can be challenging, but there's a lot of creative ways in which you can get people still involved in activities and socializing with others, even if they're confined to their room. So I think that was the last slide. You know, I know that if we give this talk 6 months, 6 months from now, we're going to know so much more about this. There's so much more that we can do. But I think, you know, the bottom line here is that these mental health issues are so key across every domain of this pandemic. They're going to continue and grow. I think we're going to see a surge in the coming days and weeks. And, you know, at the end of the day, we really have to recognize that and be in touch and contact with people. We really need one another. And finally, I'd say the key thing is, and I'm going to take this from the article I wrote in. If you're interested in that, it's the Wall Street Journal, April 20th, the article came out. And it's I think the title is something about, you know, talking with your parents about the pandemic. But what I really want to emphasize is three things. Number one is, you know, when you're with people, ask questions. Start with questions. You know, we all have our opinions and thoughts and what's going to be and our political views. Take a step back, put your agenda aside, and just ask someone, how are you doing? Do you have what you need? How is this affecting you? Just to listen, to give other people a chance to talk without having to jump in and respond and do anything more than that. Be patient. The one currency we have in abundance now is time. More time than we ever thought we'd ever have with people. So give people that time just to talk, to experience, to be with them, and be patient. You know, you don't, again, you're there just to be with them. Your presence sometimes is enough. And then the final thing I recommend with to improve communication is be empathic. You want to put yourself in their shoes. What are they experiencing? How do they understand what's going on? How are they feeling? And the more you can understand and learn this, whether it's a family member, whether it's a patient, a colleague, the better prepared you will be in terms of knowing what to do, how to intervene, or how they can help you as well. So with that, Dan, I just want to thank you again. I'm really happy to talk and present here. I love to hear other thoughts or comments people have, what you're doing at other places. You know, we have so much to learn from one another. And otherwise, thank you so much.
Thank you. And we're going to open it up to questions. I would just like to thank you, Dr. Gronin. This has, you know, you hit all the points. I think my family would say I was very much hypervigilant at the beginning of this and maybe even still now. I think that what is hard for a lot of healthcare professionals is that we didn't have the answers and we're so used to being able to deliver answers and give some type of feedback, and to not know anything about this virus has been very difficult. I would say that's been one of the most stressful things for me. It's sort of one of the things that's been driving me to figure out, okay, what is happening and what's going to happen next. I know, Dr. Pandia, you had a comment. I don't know if you want to take yourself off mute and talk.
And otherwise, Dr. Pandia, thank you. Really nice comment there.
Yeah, no, that's all I wanted to say. It's, I mean, caring works both ways. And it's really lovely to know that our patients are actually worried about us. Of course, they're very grateful we're there and that we're in any sort of shape to show up to take care of them, which is obviously a good thing. But they also ask about your health and how your family is doing. And obviously, some of the patients we've known for a long time, they know about us and our families in some shape or form. So that's all I wanted to say.
And that's a very, very nice point. And it's true. And honestly, I think that's one of the most supportive things for us, that, you know, here it is, we're the healthcare professionals caring for them. We realize that they have ways to care for us as well. That's really beautiful. That's really nice.
We did have another question that came in from Dr. Novelli about patients who may be in the facility together with their spouse and having one person become fairly ill and being unaware of that person's passing away. Like, how would you suggest that we as the primary physicians in that regard handle those type of conversations? Because
it's an interesting question, and it's something that we do see already in nursing homes. You know, I've had many couples together, and one passes away, and the other, it's almost always in the setting of, you know, someone has severe neurocognitive impairment. They don't really know or appreciate that the other has been lost. So in terms of talking or discussing with them, often, you know, that might not be an option because the person, you know, I'm assuming it's a situation in which the surviving spouse is not going to either comprehend, appreciate, or even remember the change, at least in an intellectual way. And so to tell them and get them upset and then they're going to forget about it, you're not necessarily achieving anything. And so we're always very careful with that, because I give an example of someone who loses a spouse and they ask about them. And if you tell them, well, they passed away, and they get upset, they cry, what happens an hour later, a day later, they say, oh, where's my spouse? And you tell them same thing, you're just re-traumatizing them every time if they're in the moment. You know, so in situations like that, you know, everyone's different. You have to think about what you say or tell someone that's going to be appropriate to their understanding of it. But I would say the following: we still want to be sensitive to the fact that there's a loss. And often people, and you know, this is for all of us, we can feel a loss, we can sense it, even if we don't fully know.
Thank you. I'm not sure if we have any other questions. If you could maybe speak to some of the apps and self-care resources that we're seeing coming through. I know that there was a push for in the state of Florida to have Talkspace, and then there are some other things that are available. Is there one in particular, or even if you can't name a brand, something that we should be looking at or doing as the healthcare workers?
Well, I don't know if this is the exact answer, but I tell everyone, if you don't know deep breathing relaxation, learn it. There are probably a million plus, you know, videos on YouTube and other places you can learn. But deep breathing relaxation is not only important for all of us, but it's a skill we can teach people we work with, or we can guide them through it, you know, when someone's having acute anxiety or whatnot. And so that's a really important skill. And there's, you know, any sort of relaxation app or mode that can help people, whether it's music, deep breathing, muscle relaxation in combination, I would really focus on that. I think that's really important.
Well, I thank you, Dr. Agronin. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. And thank you for just this great discussion. If there are no other questions, we will end this session. And I thank you all for attending, and I hope you could join us again next week as we talk more about COVID-19. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Diane.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.